Greetings to all of God's people. This is Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 325. And last time, we began with chapter 6 and verse 1. Actually, we covered this portion of the beginning of it, of the law of the Nazarite that concerns both men and women, as we read in verse 2. And yet, generally speaking, whenever you hear about Nazarites in the nation of Israel, mostly it is men. And I guess there would be less women who are interested in this Nazarite vow, for whatever reason. But in this case, with the exception of the long hair, you see, where women to begin with have long hair and the man doesn't have long hair, as Paul later on would make very plain. A lot of people to this very day do not understand it, the thing of Jesus Christ, because they've been deceived by false representation of Jesus Christ, that he was a man with long hair and his apostles had long hair and everybody was having long hair. And that was not the case at all. Jews never had long hair. You see, the only Jews that had long hair are the Nazarites. You see? And as soon as the period of the Nazarite vow was over, God commanded them to cut their hair. See? To look like all other men before that. But as for the women, obviously, when the Nazarite vow was over, cutting their hair was not the same as for men. You see? It's just that during that period of time, she could not touch her hair at all. And so this is what we see here. And so Paul said about men who grew their hair long, he says, don't you know that even nature teaches you that it is a shame? You see? It's a shame for a man to have long hair. Why? And he explained why. It's not a question of chauvinism. But God created man in his image and likeness, and he made him to be the head of the woman, his wife, you see. And she had long hair as a mark of submission and also a crown of glory for her. And when men began to emulate women, to begin to look like them, and men and women began to copy men, you know, they went to the point of exchanging clothes and all looked alike. Today we have the unisex concept, and you don't know which is which. And that's contrary to the law of God. And so a lot of people, you know, they think, well, that's the way Jesus Christ looked like. I want to look like that. And they think, you know, in looking like that, they're holy. And not realizing that God considers that evil thing to do. You see, as Paul said, it's a shame. So he's expressing, you know, the mind of God, that it is a shame for a man to have long hair, because he's putting himself in the place of a woman under submission, you see. And that by itself does not mean that, you know, it's put down for the woman. It's just each one of them was given a role, and they ought to look like God meant for them to look like. That's all there is to it. Every time you do something that is contrary to the law of God, you are in the wrong. And a man should not be in the position of a woman, because it is a shame, and it is a shame for a woman to be in the position of a man. You see, it goes both ways. She should not look like a man, and a man should not look like a woman, and they should not, you know, cross-dress, and, you know, and so forth. And unfortunately, a lot of people have very little understanding of the Word of God, and, you know, they are not interested in being confused with the facts. They couldn't care less about this, and so you see an awful lot of people that call themselves Christians, you know, they go to services, they go to churches, Sunday, you know, services, mostly, most of them. And they think, well, that's godly, and that's the way Christ looked like, and everybody looks at them and thinks, well, that's wonderful. That's great. You see? And God says to the Apostle Paul, no, it's a shame for a man to hang around like that. You see? One of these days, people are going to understand the law of God, and they're not going to be confused anymore by, you know, their false prophets that deceive them, and the false pictures of Jesus Christ that nobody saw to begin with. You see, all those artists that painted his picture, painting, whatever, they've never seen him. You know, they were mostly Italians. And, you know, they just imagine, because of the, you know, confusion probably on their mind, you know, he's from Nazareth, and the thing about the Nazarite vow, they had long hair. You see, that's, you know, basically ignorance, not knowledge and understanding. He's from Nazareth, which means a branch, you see, and the law that we're talking about here is about the law of the Nazir, which is a totally different word. You see, one with a Z, the other one is a TS, like Pittsburgh, you know, you know, that sound that you generally don't have in a foreign language, and they confuse the two. And so this is where they are. And so let's continue here with the law of the Nazarite. He's not allowed to do certain things. One is, he cannot drink any form of wine, anything that has been fermented, period. Both he and she, they cannot, you know, they become Nazarites. And all the days of his vow, which is the period of time that he or she would determine. It's not something that the law of God would determine, that they, in essence, devote themselves to God during that period of time as Nazarites. So God says, well, these are the rules of it. And why he made it this way, well, God knows. We don't know, you know, and understand all things. But that's why he did it, that's the law, and that's what we do. You know, if we choose, even in this day, this has not done, you know, is not done away with, even today. Men can fall into this category, or women. This law is not an Old Testament, you know, as people call it, that's old stuff, Old Testament, not applicable in the New Testament. It has nothing to do with all the New Testament, you see. It's old marriage covenant, new marriage covenant. The law is still the same. And there's no change. That's one of the great deceptions of the great whore and the harlots. There is such a thing as Old Testament and New Testament. No, there is an old marriage and new marriage, but the law remains the same. No changes. And despite the fact that Christ made it very plain that there are no changes, you know, think now that I came to destroy the law and the prophets, people are not listening to him and coming up with their own ideas. And so he said, no wine, period, and no cutting of hair, you see. Grow his hair wild, that's what it says here, pera is just, you know, wild, and not even combed. He was not even allowed to comb his hair, and she's not allowed to comb her hair. So, you know, it's a period of time where you look pretty wild. That's how John the Baptist looked all of his life. Now, this was a Nazarite. God commanded him to be a Nazarite for good. You see, it's not just a short period of time. And Samuel was also in the same category, that is his wife, in essence, devoted him for that purpose. He's not the one that came up with it. His mother actually did. And he was bound by it. And Samson was the same. In case of Samson, God is the one that commanded his parents to put him under this vow. And that's, again, for the entirety of his life. So we have few men in Israel that had long hair, but only very few. It was very easy to spot them. And Jesus Christ, you know, certainly did not have long hair, or it would have been very easy to spot him. You know, he would have been one of the very few that has it. And yet, you know, it took, the priest had to pay Judas 30 shekels of silver to spot the man, you know. Well, if he has long hair, you don't need anybody to spot him because everybody knows who he is. You know, that shows you the ignorance that is there, and people couldn't care less about that. And so, his hair or her hair must be wild, you know, uncombed, all the days of their vow. And another law, that we read here in verse 6, all the days, we read it here, in verse 5, all the days of his vow of the Nazariteship, there shall be no razor come upon his head, you see, can never cut anything, even a little bit, until the days be fulfilled, in which he consecrates himself, or she consecrates herself, unto the Eternal. He shall be holy. That is set apart, sanctified, and those are the laws of the sanctification. You see, so in his case, when God says, be you holy, for I am holy, obviously he's not talking about this limitations here that the Nazarite had. You know, God doesn't hang around with long hair. But for them, these were the laws of holiness and sanctification. And so during this time when they consecrated themselves unto the Eternal for total devotion, that's what it's supposed to look like. And everybody that sees them, you know, can immediately spot the situation and realize, well, this is the Nazarite. And so it says, he shall be, or she shall be holy. He shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow long. That's the only time when an Israelite could have long hair. You see? And no other Israelite was allowed to have long hair, because the whole community would have taken care of that pretty quick. If he hangs with a long hair, that means he's deceiving the community that he's under the Nazarite vow. So obviously he would not do it. Nobody would ever do it. And no woman would do it. You see? That was very simple, very basic. Verse 6, all the days that he consecrates himself unto the eternal, he shall not come near a dead body. So neither man or woman could do it, because that's supposed to be holy. Like the priests. The priests were not allowed to do it, period. You see? They cannot touch at all a dead body, unless they are, in the case of the priesthood, personal relations, like father, mother, brother, sister, things like that. And so that's what we read here in verse 7. He shall not make himself unclean for his father or for his mother. You see, in his case, no exception. He is like in the case of the high priest. He shall not make himself unclean for his father or his mother, for his brother or his sister, when they die, because his consecration unto God is upon his head. So he's in a very, very state of holiness here, where he's not allowed, period, to touch anything that is unholy or to do anything that is unholy. Verse 8, all the days of his Nazariteship, he is holy unto the eternal. And if any man die very suddenly beside him, you know, things happen, and you walk around, with one of your friends, and he walks by, and suddenly he has a heart attack, and he falls, and he's dead. You touch him, you didn't plan for it. That's why it says if something like that happens suddenly beside him, and he defile his consecrated head. You see, in touching him, he's being defiled. Then he shall shave his head, and shave does not mean you totally remove everything that you have on your hair. You cut your hair, basically. You shall shave his head in the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day shall he shave it. So, the shaving in those days obviously was not the kind of shaving that we have today. They didn't have the same kind of equipment. But basically, just like when you go to the army, you see how they remove their hair. Well, that's the way they're supposed to do after the Nazarite vow is over. But it's not the shaving that some do, Yul Brynner haircut. Verse 10, and on the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves. So this is what he's supposed to do, if he touches a dead body. And for that matter, any unclean thing that he's not supposed to touch. And so he's going to shave his head in the day of his cleansing. And on the seventh day he shall shave it. And on the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves or two young pigeons to the priest to the door of the tent of meeting. So everything is to the door of the tent, couldn't go inside. And the priest shall prepare one for a sin offering. It's not a sin offering in the sense that, he'd done something wrong, morally, things like that. They say it's not an attitude problem, but it's ceremonially defiled. And so that's what he's talking about here. And the other for a burnt offering, and make atonement for him. For that he sinned by reason of the dead. And so we have to understand the difference between this and the other one. Just like we read in the book of, that is in the epistles of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, you read that there is a sin unto death, and there is a sin that is not unto death. So this is one kind of a sin that is not unto death, you see. And God says, well, this is what you do. There are many categories of sins which are not unto death. In other cases, the death penalty hangs over you. And that's not only talking about the Ten Commandments, because there are many, many laws for which the death penalty was applied. That had nothing to do with the Ten. And so God said, he shall consecrate, he shall be consecrated unto the Lord. And actually in verse 11, let's continue that. He shall make atonement for him, for that he sinned by reason of the dead, and he shall hallow his head that same day. In other words, sanctify his head. And you sanctify your head when you offer the sacrifice, and you're sanctified again. And he shall consecrate unto the Lord the days of his Nazariteship, and shall bring a he lamb of the first year for a guilt offering. But the former days, but the former days shall be void. In other words, that period of time that he dedicated to God, which he desecrated by touching unclean thing, in this case a human being, well, that doesn't count in terms of the number of the days that he devoted himself, or months or weeks or whatever it may be, to God. So that's void, null and void, it's gone. and then he's going to start all over again. And so, he shall consecrate himself unto the Lord, verse 12, the days of his Nazarite-ship, and shall bring a he lamb of the first offering for guilt offering, but the former day shall be void, because his consecration was defiled. And this is the Torah, or the law, Torah in Hebrew, of the Nazarite. So as we mentioned several times, the Torah is a generic name for everything, the entirety of the body of teachings, you see. And then within it there were divisions, and each one of them was called the Torah. Subdivisions, you might say. And verse 13, and this is the law, the Torah of the Nazarite. When the days of his consecration are fulfilled, he shall bring it unto the door of the tent of meeting, and he shall present his offering unto the Lord, one he lamb of the first year without blemish for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb of the first of the year, of the, that is the first year without blemish, was always the first year, 1 year, and for a sin offering, and one ram without blemish for a peace offering. It's, you know, it's a pretty expensive deal here, and obviously people did not take this kind of things lightly. Now, they had, you know, several reasons why they wanted to consecrate themselves to be Nazarites, and it could be all kind of things. And they were not just frivolous things or, you know, meaningless things. Very, very important things in the life of a human being. And so, God gave them these laws to fulfill in those cases. And of course, you know, when we are so far away from it, from this way of life, from the law of God, from the mind of God, from the nature of God, you know, a lot of people may read that and think, well, that's all strange. What's that all about? Well, the ways of God begin to be strange to us if we are so far away from it into another way of life, another world, another mind, another spirit, you see. And then when we are walking in the ways of God, then the other way looks, you know, very strange and totally different, far out. That's in essence what happens to all of us. Any time we come across any laws of the Bible, you know, of God here, of the Torah, if we feel that, that should be an indication of how far we are from God. That's as simple as that. And that's a wake-up calling when we begin to feel that way. That we have departed so far from God that His law, His mind, His nature and character, you know, some of His teachings seem to be strange to us. A lot of people don't realize that when they study the Word of God. And so they just go about their merry way and the thing that they're okay while everybody else was weird in those days. And they don't realize they are the ones who are in that category. And so this is what it's supposed to bring, an offering. And then in verse 15 we read, and a basket of unleavened bread, cakes of fine flour mingled with oil, and unleavened wafers spread with oil. This is a good meal here. You bring it to the temple, and a part of it is offered, and then a part of it is eaten. And the unleavened wafers spread with oil, and their meal offering, and their drink offerings. You know, they brought wine. And the priest shall bring them before the Eternal, and shall offer his sin offering and his burnt offering. And he shall offer the ram for a sacrifice of peace offerings unto the Eternal with the basket of unleavened bread. So all that is offered to God. The priest shall offer also the meal offering thereof, and the drink offering, generally wine. And so you see this this kind of a meal, of, that is, beside the flesh, you see the bread and the wine in so many ceremonies. Passover is just one of them. And it all then symbolized basically the same thing, you see. And when that was done on the Last Supper by Jesus Christ, it was not something that was strange and out of the way, or something new. Some people, you know, in their ignorance, having no knowledge of the law, they think, well, you know, here's Christ inventing something new, and he's replacing the sacrificial meal. That's total ignorance, which is very pathetic. You know, that people depart so far from the law of God that they even come to this point where they even think that way, and then teach it as a doctrine. Unfortunately, people do not study the law of God to like the Bereans. Prove it, whether those things are so. Don't do it, you see. And so, when the blind leads the blind, and they all fall into the ditch. And unfortunately, every single one of us can be that blind person and lead others into blindness when we do not study the law of God and meditate on it day and night. And people who do not do it are going to be blind and are going to lead others astray into false doctrines and false teachings. You see, and God is not a respecter of persons. And it's important for all of us to always be aware of that. I know many times, you know, when I don't pay enough attention to the law, you know, I may say something that is not correct, you see. In that sense, I'm leading people astray in that. And I have to come back and find out, no, that's not correct, and correct it, you know, and acknowledge it. And, you know, pick up the pieces, stand up, and keep going. That's the way the righteous, you know, people are. They may fall 70 times. Though they may fall 70 times, they rise up, you know, recognize what they've done wrong, admit it, confess it, God demands that. I'd be haughty and arrogant and, you know, play games so well, and I just justify and bring all kind of excuses. Just get it out of our chest, you know, admit it when we find it, and, you know, do what we need to do and go on. You know, that's the way the people of God are. And others, you know, their ego is in the way, and their pride and arrogance and haughtiness and all that, obviously, that makes it extremely difficult for them to follow the law of God in this case. What is to be done after you have found out that you were wrong, or you've done something wrong, or you've been guilty, you say, oh, you've committed iniquity, you know, be it presumptuously or be it out of ignorance, whatever it may be. That's why God in all these offerings and sacrifices covers every aspect, in essence, of human nature in terms of these instructions, what to do in those cases. And so we read here, and the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the door of the tent of meeting. That's exactly when the man and the woman were supposed to do it. You know, after you do it, you know, you go back home, everybody looks at you, and they realize the days of your Nazarite vow are over, and from now, you know, you just gotta take your time, you know, for your head to grow back. And from a distance, you would know which is which for a while, and after a while, you begin to know who is the man, who is the woman. And the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the door of the tent of meeting, and shall take the hair of his consecrated head and put it on the fire. You see? It's supposed to burn it. Don't take it home and make something else out of it. And so you put it on the fire, which is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. So you don't put it on the sacrifice itself, but under it. You see? You burn it, you get rid of it. It's a part of... at this point it becomes sin, you see? So you burn it. Verse 19, that's what you do with sin. You burn it, and that's why when we become sin, we get burned like a fire. You see? That's basically the same treatment. Verse 19, and the priest shall take the shoulder of the ram when it is sodden, and 1 unleavened cake of the basket, and 1 unleavened wafer, and shall put them upon the hands of the Nazarite. So those are items that he was supposed to do after he has shaven his consecrated head. And, you know, they had to follow exactly to the detail everything that God gave them. No man invents anything. It's not church doctrine. You know, that's a silly term when you think about it. What do you mean church doctrine? You know, the church sits down and invents the law of God? Of course not. There's no such a thing as church doctrine. That's the teaching of the law of God. This is where it proceeded, from the mouth of God, and the church certainly is not God. And it'll an awful lot of people within that organization, any given organization, like to play this game. You know, play the game of God. I'm God. And so they call it church doctrine. Well, that tells you, you know, what's on their mind when they even use this terminology. You see, church doctrine. Well, and then you have different churches, and all their churches, you know, all the different churches have their own doctrines. So everything is a church doctrine. And what about the law of God? The law of God is one. There isn't confusion there. It's the same for all. You see? Not to justify our confusion, to justify the fact that we're Babylonians through and through in so many ways. So, you know, we have to change the terminology and call it church doctrine. And then you say, well, that's my doctrine, you know, that's my church, and this is your church, you know, we can all live in peace happily together and all that. You see? That's confusion in Babylon. That's why we have to meditate on the law of God day and night, and as God said very plainly, in many ways, one law, not several church doctrines, you see, human terminology, children of Babylon that come up with it, but one law, one Torah, he said, shall be to all of you Israelites and the strangers among you. There is no religion for the Jews and religion for the Gentiles. You see, that's another demonic invention by the great whore and the harlots, and people fall for it. And they think that, well, that's the way it is. You know, people may tolerate the Jews, you know, more than others, you know, the Gentile church, so to speak, They think, well, you know, God gave you one law and He gave us one law, and, you know, that's your church doctrine or your synagogue doctrine. This is our church doctrine. And, you know, let's all be brothers, live happily ever after. You see? All this is confusion of mind and heart. And the priests could not play these kind of games. They could not say, well, you know, in our denomination, that's the way we do things. You know, in your denomination, that's the way you do things. There's no such a thing. God is one. His law is one. His teachings are one. And if we are, you know, different from each other, it's because we're children of Babylon. That's for, you know, the reason why God tells us, come out of Babylon. Here's my law. As Moses made it very plain. This is the law. You don't add to it. You don't diminish from it. And that's what church doctrine is all about. People who have added or diminished from the law of God. You see? Then it becomes a man-made religion. And in essence, when they said church doctrine, they're true. That's their church doctrine. That doesn't mean God's law. And we have to learn to know the difference between the two. And don't take anybody's word for it. You go to the book itself, like the Bereans did. You know, all due respect, the tall pole, fine, you know, it sounds interesting. We are not sure if it's true. You know, why are we going to trust men? You see, God commanded us not to trust men. So they went to the Bible, they opened it, and they said, oh yeah, that's exactly what he said. This is what it says here, you see. That's the law of God. That's not church doctrine. So Paul was not teaching church doctrine. Nobody was ever. No man of God ever teaches church doctrine. You see, the church teaches the law of God, the teachings of God, the words that proceeded out of the mouth of God, not inventions of men. Now, church also, being human beings, you know, there are certain rules and regulations that we do as human beings. That's beside the point. There's nothing wrong with that. You see, that's in every society you do it. But when we talk about the law of God, the teachings that came out of the mouth of God, you see, that would determine whether you're holy or not, that whether you're sinful or not, you see, there's no such a thing in this case of church doctrine. This is the law of God. And, you know, that's one thing that we have to clear our minds of. You know, the garbage that was injected into our minds and all this debris and everything else, that is not of God. Even our thinking is not proper, as it should be. And so in verse 20 we read, and the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Eternal. That's, you know, the items that he gave him to hold in his hands. And this is holy for the priest. So this part become the property of the priest, together with the breast of waving and the thigh of heaving. And after that, the Nazarite may drink wine. You see? He cannot be a Baptist. There is a sect that invented their own church doctrine. We don't drink wine. That's not of God. And so they think, well, you know, John the Baptist, you know, we're called the Baptist. John the Baptist didn't drink wine, but John the Baptist was a Nazarite. You see? Consecrated to God. Had long hair. Didn't drink wine. Didn't shave his hair. Didn't touch dead body. You see? That's a special category. And they certainly are not in that. So it's foolishness for them to come up with a doctrine, you know, add to the law of God or diminish, do their own thing, and they think that they're holy before God. No, they are not. You see, that's unfortunate what people do. And as soon as that is over, the law of the Nazarite, he can go back to drink wine like he did before. And Jesus Christ certainly drank wine. So he was not a Nazarite, therefore he didn't have long hair. You see, and some people even called him Wine Bieber because he went to parties, you know, Pharisees and scribes. And we're not talking about wild parties that, you know, we have today. You know, they sat together and ate and drank and discussed things. And generally it was biblical discussions. And he drank wine. He was not a Nazarite. He was from Nazareth, the branch, Tzemach, plant. See, it's all the same. Spoken of in different places, different ways. Like in Isaiah 11, other places. Or in Zechariah, you hear about, you know, him, behold the branch. And it has nothing to do with a Nazarite. Nazir. Nazir means to abstain. That's what it means, you see. That's a totally different thing. And he was not an ascetic. And that's what people do. They, you know, right and left, they go wrong. Do their own thing, invent their own church doctrines, and they think they are holy people, and they are not. They are defiled people. And they are not of God. And so, we read here that when that is over, then he may drink wine. Then verse 21, this is the Torah of the Nazarite who vows and of his offering unto the Eternal for his Nazariteship, beside that for which his means suffice, according to his vow which he vows. So he must do after the law of his Nazarite-ship. Not do his own thing, not invent his own doctrines and ideas, you see, not follow so-called church doctrine, which are doctrines of men, you see, and oftentimes they take the word of God and they twist it and pervert it and dement it and warp it, give it their own interpretation, and they call it church doctrine. Yes, it is. It's church doctrine, but it's not the law of God. And God says, no, you must do exactly as you are told. You don't go to the right, you don't go to the left. If it's not the word that proceeded out of the mouth of God, don't do it. Because if you do, it's lawlessness. You see, and God is going to hold it against you. And a lot of people are under condemnation, and they are going their own merry way, thinking that they're doing great. And they're not. Verse 22, you know, they even bear false witness. When you think about that, when a person claims that he's a Christian, you see, well, he's saying by that, well, I'm following Christ. But if you despise his law, if you do your own thing, you're bearing false witness. You're a liar. An awful lot of liars out there who despise the law of God and do not walk by it, including many people, you know, think themselves they're good people and have the Holy Spirit and the other people of God. They do their own thing. You see, they have to follow their own church doctrines, not the law of God in its purity. So we read in verse 22. Now let's repeat that again. Actually, in verse 21, the last part. So he or she or they or anybody must do after the Torah. In this case, of the Nazarite. But whatever Torah God gives us, we must do it. Not must invent our own ideas and concepts. Verse 22, and the Eternal spoke unto Moses, saying, speak unto Aaron. You see, this is the word of God that we live by. It came directly from the mouth of God, the one that became Jesus Christ. We're talking about, you know, you want to be a Christian, you follow his law. From Genesis 1:1 until Revelation, the last verse. He's the one that spoke to us personally, even though you read in Hebrew that in the old days he spoke to us by the prophets, and true, generally speaking by the prophets, but he spoke to the prophets. You see, so he spoke to them personally. He spoke to Moses for 40 years, face to face. You see, so in that sense, there was nothing new about it. And now he came in the flesh and he spoke in person as a human being. And that's in essence what Paul is talking about in the book of Hebrews. It's not that he never spoke to the fathers. No, it's the father that himself never spoke to mankind personally. You see, he spoke through his son, and who dealt with mankind on a personal basis from the Garden of Eden, and otherwise he spoke to them through the prophets in visions or dreams or sometimes in person. And certainly all that still was different than when he came in the flesh and dwelt among them, ate with them, you know, walked with them and ran with them, played with them, whatever it may be, wrestled, argued, debated, whatever it may be. So, you know, it was a totally different experience. Nevertheless, it's the same person, the same God, the same law. No changes there. Verse 22, and the Eternal spoke unto Moses, saying, speak unto Aaron and unto his sons, saying, on this wise ye shall bless the children of Israel. So when he blessed the children of Israel, God says, I'm going to tell you what to say. And to this very day, when you walk into a synagogue on the Sabbath day, you see the priests to this very day who are known as priests, because that's their name, you see. You do not take upon yourself the name Kohen or Kahan and all the different ways where they say it, Katz. There are several ways, actually. As time went by, Katz basically is the abbreviation of Kohen Tzedek, priest of righteousness. But all of this, Kahana, they say, oh, or Kuhn, or Kunin, you see. In many ways that they changed it, you know, once they went abroad with other cultures and nations, but still it's the same. And the community always know who is a priest. Why? Because, you know, his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather. It's not something that you come up one day, you show up and you say, I'm a priest. Oh, yeah. Who is your father? You see? Your father was not a priest. Well, how come you are a priest? So that was one way of keeping tab on them. And so when they, to this very day, stand in the synagogue at a certain part of the service after the reading of the law, they still do it to this very day. So the function of the priesthood never ceased. You see, because much of the priesthood was not the tabernacle, was not the sacrifices. Much of the priesthood had to do with teaching, with instructions, with judgment, with healing. You see, an awful lot of their job was not sacrifices and rituals. It was so many other things, because they were wearing many hats. Education, music, everything. All those things still go on to this very day. And if they are busy doing it, well, they're still continuing in the office of the priesthood. So this is one thing at least they do on the Sabbath. Stand up in front of the congregation and bless Israel. And this is what they say here. And this is where it originated. And mind you, it's only the sons of Aaron that can do it. You know, as time went by, sometimes, you know, they didn't have a priest in the synagogue, so the rabbis decided, well, we don't have a priest in the synagogue, but we won't steal the blessing of God, so you find in some synagogues, even though there is a priest there, because, you know, as time went by, people begin to do their own thing, and the rabbis oftentimes are the ones that pronounce this statement, you see. And sometimes you see a woman doing that there, and sometimes even children do that. And obviously, all that is not according to the law of God. And yet, this is the office of the priest, and that's what they're supposed to do to this very day, and many of them still do. So he said, you tell Aaron and his sons, not Levites, only Aaron and his sons, whoever his sons are to this very day, on this wise you shall bless the children of Israel. You shall say unto them, the Eternal bless you. It's not me. It's not the blessing of the priest. That's called, you know, Birchat Kohanim. And it's a blessing of the priest. That means they are the ones that are pronouncing it. But the blessing is God doing it. You see? And if God sees a woman, you know, proclaiming these words, he's not going to honor it. And if he sees a Levite doing it, he's not going to honor it. And if he sees a rabbi doing it, he's not going to honor it. You see? Because that's not in accordance with his law. And people that have no respect for God, they begin to do their own thing. And they think it's okay. So God says, this is what they say, the Eternal bless you and keep you. The Eternal make his face shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Eternal will lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And to this very day, this is what many priests are still doing. Sometimes you go to a Messianic synagogue and you see somebody there, he's not a priest, he's nothing. When it comes to that, and not a priest, he's not a son of a priest, he's not a rabbi, whatever it may be, but, you know, he's just a leader of the congregation, and he does that, and I've heard that several times. You know, it sounds cute and nice and all that, and never dawns on them. Now, wait a minute. There is God. He has a law. He does not want us to mess around with his law. He gives us commandments, what to say, what not to say, what to do, what not to do. That's how we become holy, when we're sanctified by his word, washed by his word, not do our own thing. And yet the things that they're followers of Christ, and they praise him and sing to him and all these things, and at the same time they defile his law. You see, rebel against him and against his word and against his law. And it's so unfortunate to see people like that, you know, just blind as a bat, and they don't understand it. Not that they are vicious and evil, but God is not a respecter of persons. He doesn't want people to play games with his word. You see, he really demands total obedience. And we cannot do that if we do not do it in accordance with his instructions. So, he says, this is what they do. Verse 27, so shall they put my name, and we have no right of putting God's name if God didn't tell us, you can put my name, because first, God is not going to even listen to it or accept it. Second, we're bearing false witness, claiming that God placed us in this position to put his name on others. You see? Now you've got their iniquity there both ways. And that's very serious in the sight of God. And so it says, they shall put my name, they, no others, my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them. You see? Otherwise, I'm not going to. A lot of people are just yakking an awful lot in the thing that they're talking to God or in the name of God and so forth. And that's all it is. A bunch of empty words that are totally meaningless. You see, and we should never find ourselves in this. That's what David would call a presumptuous sin. A lot of people don't realize that. So they pray, you know, now and then, you know. So they heard that statement of David, you know, deliver me from presumptuous sin, and they go ahead and do it anyway. And that's very pathetic. Chapter 7, verse 1. And it came to pass on the day that Moses had made an end of setting up the tabernacle and had anointed it and sanctified it. We're talking still in the first year in the wilderness in Sinai. That's still there. And all the furniture thereof and the altar and all the vessels thereof, and had anointed them and sanctified them, that the princes of Israel, that is, they lifted up, the exalted of Israel, that's what princes are, the heads of their fathers' houses offered this were the princes of the tribes. So when that was finished, the tabernacle is finished, everything is set in order, the nation is established, the constitution is given, you see, and all in a very short time. From barbarian way of life as slaves, you see, to suddenly structured nation in detail. Imagine that, all in 1 year, with total education, and all of them knew that, because all these things that God gave to Moses, he repeated them immediately to Israel, and all of them. So, you know, 1 year, they went from kindergarten to college, university, and grade school, you know, that is postgraduate classes and all these things, all in 1 year. And that's what God did with his people, you see. So he did not marry a woman that was ignorant, you see, and confused, and doing her own thing, and you know, each one does their own thing, and the whole thing is they're his people, you know, we are all the people of God, we are the wife of the of God, and things like that. Now they all had one law, one God, one doctrine, you see, one faith, and that's exactly what the Apostle Paul was talking about, and people do not have a background, really do not fully comprehend what he's talking about, you see. That's exactly what is happening here. So when all that was done, now the leaders of the nation, you see, that now became a nation, full-fledged nation in every way, they now come before God and they bring their offerings in the name of all of Israel again. Just like in the beginning they all did on a personal basis with, for the building of the tabernacle, now they all come on an official basis where everything is already established, and they bring now their offerings in the name of the congregation. And so we read about the princes of Israel, the leaders of Israel, the heads of their fathers' houses offered. This were the princes of the tribes. These are they that were over them, that were numbered. And mind you, God is the one that sends them over. You know, it's not self-appointment. Either a civil appointment or a religious appointment. It's all by the hand of God. Verse 3. And they brought their offerings before the Eternal, 6 covered wagon and 12 oxen, a wagon for every 2 of the princes. And for each 1 ox, and they presented them before the Eternal, before the tabernacle. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, take it of them, that they may be to do the service of the tent of meeting. Because you see, you know, when they traveled, they needed to carry a lot of things. And some things they had to carry only on their shoulders, you see. But there were many other things. They did not have to put it on the shoulders, and so they needed wagons for that. So they did not give something that was unnecessary, you know, just meaningless. In other words, they had instructions there. What is it that is good to be brought there and useful for the tabernacle? And that's exactly what they did. So there's a lot of background information there that obviously is not recorded. But you can see, ultimately speaking, you see total order, harmony, and unity in communication. And nothing is left to chance. And people do not do their own thing. And everything is in accordance with the will of God. That's the God of Israel, the God of righteousness and truth and order, and not the God of Babylon. You see, confusion in which, unfortunately, many of us are to this very day. Verse 4, and the Lord spoke unto Moses, take it of them, that they may be to do the service of the tent of meeting, and you shall give them unto the Levites, to every man according to his service. So, if you need it, if you are in a position where you need it, well, you get it. But if you don't need it, you don't get it. You see? And basically, that's the way it worked. And that's the nature of God. It tells you an awful lot about the mind and the nature of God. I mean, when people study this law day and night, they begin to absorb the nature and the mind of God, and they begin to function like that until they come to the point where they are fully that kind of a person. Then when God gives us a spirit body, it's not just suddenly we become spirit beings and divine beings, you know, and deities, so to speak, Elohim. It's something that has been happening from the beginning of time. It's a process. A lot of people don't realize that. That's why we have to grow in grace and knowledge and understanding until we fully comprehend and understand and live by it. And so it's not just, you know, poof, and you are my son. It doesn't work like that. And the people who are not going to be doing this kind of work all along, they'll come to that point that they are going to be found naked, without garments of righteousness, without character, without knowledge and understanding. And we cannot afford to be that. And yet the majority of so-called, you know, religious people are that way. They are as ignorant as they can be of the quote-unquote the doctrines of their church. And that's not acceptable before God. God wants every single one of us, and all of Israel here were fully knowledgeable of all these things. It's not a nation or people of ignorance. Verse 6, we read, and Moses took the wagons and the oxen and gave them unto the Levites, 2 wagons and 4 oxen he gave unto the sons of Gershon according to their service, and 4 wagons and 8 oxen he gave unto the sons of Merari according unto their service under the hand of Itamar the son of Aaron the priest. So everything was done in order. And of course, according to the law of God. And then we read in verse 9, but unto the sons of Kohath he gave none, because of the service of the holy things belonged unto them, and they bore upon their shoulders. And that's where they were supposed to do it, and not on wagons. And when Uzzah did not pay attention to this law of God in the days of David, God smote him, because God, our God, is a consuming fire. It's a fearful thing to fall into the hand of the Eternal. And, you know, that should be a lesson to all of us. Anyway, we'll stop at this point. Mordecai Joseph, greetings to all of God's people. Until next time.